You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 31st of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, once a prisoner, now a politician. Aung San Suu Kyi makes her first overseas trip in 24 years. But will she be as effective an advocate for Burmese democracy now that she's actually allowed to be one? The world's most famous skyline anticipates a new peak. The corner of Park Avenue and 56th might be about to become America's tallest residential address. As the former mayor of Beijing mutters something rueful about what happened in his city's main square in 1989, we'll consider the art of the public apology. And how much would you pay to find out what 200-year-old champagne tastes like? Some people, it turns out, will pay rather a lot. All of that, plus some great music as well, all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before we get into all that, the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has criticized Russia's resistance to UN action on Syria, warning that its continued support for the Assad regime could contribute to a civil war. Mrs. Clinton told an audience of students in Copenhagen that unless unchecked, the deadly violence in Syria could lead to civil war or even develop into a proxy war because of Iran's support for the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. She said she had spoken on Wednesday to the international envoy on Syria, Kofi Annan, who's trying to expand his mandate to be able to deal more effectively with Damascus. Israel has handed over to the Palestinian government the remains of 91 militants, including suicide bombers, in a move it said was designed to induce Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to renew peace talks. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Yigal Palmor explained.
We have decided on this measure for humanitarian reasons. This is a measure intended to build confidence. It's a goodwill measure, and we hope it will be accepted as such. Our hope is still to renew negotiations with the Palestinians without any preconditions as soon as possible.
However, Palestinian leaders signaled no shift in their refusal to negotiate as long as Israel continued building settlements on land where they hope to establish a state. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Greece has given a warning over what it said was the rise of racist violence in the country, where large numbers of migrants arrive every year. The group says the financial crisis that swept the country has weakened efforts to tackle the issue. Georgios Sabopoulos, the head of the UNHCR in Greece, said that he was concerned by the rise in incidents over the past 18 months.
I would say very serious, since apart from the continuous pressure of mixed migration movements at the borders, Greece being the main gate today for the European Union for thousands of refugees and migrants, we also have the financial crisis, as you know, and also an increase of incidents of racist violence the last 1.5 years.
The International Monetary Fund Deputy Managing Director Nemat Shafik has said that Eurozone countries could be given more time to cut their budget deficits below 3% of GDP. Eurozone countries signed a fiscal treaty by which they're obliged to cut budget deficits below 3% in 2013. Ms. Shafik acknowledged that this goal may be hard to reach in times of economic crisis and said some flexibility should be allowed. She also supported the ECB's and Eurozone ideas of creating a bank resolution fund, a pan-Eurozone bank deposit guarantee scheme, and Eurozone financial supervision.
And to ensure that banks that receive pan-European support are properly restructured and supervised, these banks could be over time be made subject to centralized regulation and supervision through a joint banking resolution authority.
The European Commission President José Manuel Barroso yesterday called for greater integration through a fiscal and banking union. Some countries, like Germany, have been resisting the idea so far. The mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, has called for a municipal ban on sales of supersized sugary drinks in an attempt to tackle obesity. He wants to stop the city's outlets from selling large sizes of sweetened soft drinks. Research suggests that 58% of adults in New York are obese or overweight. However, a spokesman for the New York City Beverage Association criticized the measures as overzealous. Those are the main stories here at Monocle 24.
Thanks, James. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, és Tokyo. Ez a Monocle 24.
Velkommen til Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
Λοντόστα Κασίν, τämä on Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, ez a Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπουρσέ, Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, sino Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que você está no Monocle 24.
Aftor no Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, tagat ja.
Welcome back to Midori House. For a very long time, famously, Aung San Suu Kyi didn't go anywhere. The Burmese opposition figurehead and Nobel Prize laureate, peace laureate that is, spent 15 of the last 22 years under house arrest. Released in late 2010 and elected to Burma's parliament earlier this year, she's now undertaking her first trip out of the country in 24 years to the World Economic Forum in Bangkok. Aung San Suu Kyi's presence has prompted a frenzy of flashbulbs of the sort usually only provoked by the public appearance of one of those people who is on television all the time without anybody really knowing why. And while it's always nice to see attention paid to someone who's done something to deserve it, is there a chance of Aung San Suu Kyi becoming more famous than her cause? Joining me now from Bangkok is Gwen Robinson, the Bangkok correspondent of the Financial Times, who is attending the WEF. Good evening, Gwen.
Good evening.
How frantic has the attention paid to Aung San Suu Kyi been?
Well, it's strange because when she ventures out, there's sort of mobs everywhere and media frenzies and cameras inside. I mean, for example, today I walked into a session just to listen to a panel actually on security in Southeast Asia and the South China Sea, and noticed she was quietly sitting in the front row as part of the audience, listening to the discussants very modestly and taking notes, or at least her assistant was taking notes. And, you know, she's participating in this thing really as another delegate. But then I suppose you do have a meeting here where there's quite a few heads of state. We've got, you know, the Thai Prime Minister dropping in and out, and the Prime Ministers of Vietnam and Laos, the President of Indonesia, various other bigwigs. So in a way, I guess in that sort of company, it's not a huge thing. And outside, she's a rock star. And she had a lot of media and fans sort of following her around to her visits to a Burmese migrant worker centre near Bangkok yesterday, and she went again today. But it's quite remarkable to see how she's approaching this historic first, you know, step outside the country in 24 years, and also, let's not forget, most of that under house arrest, and suddenly she's in this, you know, sort of five-star hotel on the river in the middle of Bangkok, surrounded by about 600 people from all over the world, including top executives and politicians, and how she's sort of handling that all with quite cool, collected calm.
I mean, is she the sole focus of that kind of public attention, or is the presence of the event itself a big deal for Bangkok?
Well, actually, I think there's elements of both. I mean, there is a star quality about her, and it's hard to keep in mind that actually, technically and officially, she's really only a minor opposition leader from a Southeast Asian country. She's now got 40 a total of 43 members, including herself, in Parliament. That's out of 664 seats in the National Parliament and some more in Regional Parliament. So she would, by any standards, be a sort of minor politician, but actually I think all the leaders and chief executives and heavyweights at the conference are in awe of her, and you do see some people approaching her and wanting to have photos taken with her. So it's a bit of both. I mean, you get a lot of people who are sitting next to her in panel discussions not really treating her any differently from others. I spoke to her tonight at the big official dinner, and you know, she was sitting at one of the tables next to the Indonesian trade minister, actually, and sort of discussing, and people were approaching her. But it's sort of low key compared to. I saw one article sort of making note that she's arrived just after Lady Gaga sort of took Bangkok by storm, and that was a kind of mob scene with wild fans. And in fact, her own rock star quality is much more variable, let's say.
It's a strange phenomenon, though, when you get that political figure who also becomes a celebrity in the modern sense of a celebrity, i.e. that somebody that everybody recognises without necessarily being sure why. And I think you could look at other examples in recent years of sort of the Dalai Lama or, to a slightly lesser extent, Nelson Mandela. What does it mean, do you think, for the cause when one person comes to embody it? Is it a help or a hindrance?
Well, I think that's an extremely good point, very good point. And a question I pose to various people, both in Myanmar and outside, is, you know, what if something awful happened to her suddenly? You know, what would happen to this whole movement that she started? And in fact, there is no apparent heir. Everyone acknowledges that. That's partly because she's such a forceful, and also she's a unique figure. No one can easily step in her shoes. So, in fact, yes, you're right. In some ways, she's bigger than her cause. I don't think she particularly wants that, although inadvertently, perhaps, and unintentionally, she's created her own distinct brand. I mean, she's always there in her trademark, beautifully tailored, immaculate outfits, which are based on traditional designs, always beautiful patterns and fabrics, and very nicely fitting, and flowers in her hair, and always sort of gliding along serenely. And in that way, she's become a very iconic figure. And that kind of, I think, reinforces that star quality. She, in her goings around town and in her talks and public talks and also in conversations with smaller groups, she always emphasises, you know, the big issues, democracy. She had a private, she popped into a very small discussion last night for young emerging ASEAN leaders, and they hadn't expected her at all. It was completely unannounced, and she sat there for an hour and a half talking to these younger people who'd come in from various of the 10 countries in ASEAN to attend this meeting, and ask them their thoughts on education and, you know, issues like that. She talked to migrant workers about their issues of being migrant workers in Thailand, and a promise that she'd help them. So, you know, she's always emphasising the big issues, but inadvertently I think she has created a kind of personality cult, and without her, one wonders what who would take up the baton, actually, and who would indeed have that kind of authority or cachet that she seems to hold, even to the point where you do get these powerful chief executives and people like that wanting to, you know, really being very much in awe and wanting to have photos with her and things like that.
Do you have any sense of how, I mean, it's very early days in her career as a parliamentarian, but do you have any sense of whether or not she feels at all co-opted or compromised by the fact that she's now actually does have a role in the Burmese government that she's campaigned against for so long?
Well, that's right. It's not quite government, it's parliament, but that is the parliament that she has vowed to try and change through constitutional change, which does allocate automatically 25% of all the seats to military, to appoint as the military wants, whoever they would like to put in those seats. And she has spoken out against that system. However, you know, with her historic decision after she was released to participate in these by-elections on April the 1st, I think that was in a way accepting the rules of the country as they stand, even though she has said she wants to change those rules. So she ran for Parliament under those rules, and that's why in some ways there was a huge wobble when after she had won the landslide victory, 43 out of 45 seats for her NLD party. There was a huge wobble in on the day they were supposed to take their seats up and be sworn into Parliament as new MPs. Just a few days before that, she announced she would not take a seat unless the President or the Parliament changed the wording of an oath of allegiance that new MPs have to swear to sit in Parliament. And she was taking issue with the word that they had to safeguard the Constitution, the very document she's vowed to change. And she wanted them to change the wording to respect the Constitution, which I think in Burmese has a very significant difference in meaning. However, you know, critics said, well, you know, she ran under those rules. She decided to contest the elections and to actually hold the whole process up of taking her seat, arguing that they had to change the oath. Was actually a big disappointment to all her supporters. This standoff went on, as you might recall, for about 8 days, 9 days, and no one knew what would happen, because the very stubbornness she was displaying over that was what buoyed her through 14, 15 years of house arrest. And she's got tremendous, tremendous drive and commitment, and that, in a good way, makes her what she is, the great democracy campaigner. But in a bad way, I suppose, it makes it impossible for her to climb down. In fact, she did finally come round and accept it. She announced to the country she was yielding to the will of the people and all those who had voted for her. And she took that much protested oath and took her seat. She only had a few days in, I think a couple of days in Parliament before it broke for its big summer session. And she will return to Parliament in July. But that will be after her next big trip, which will be landing in England in mid-June, not long from now, and Norway, Switzerland, and other places. She'll go and collect her Nobel Prize, which she was awarded many years ago when she was under house arrest, and address British Parliament. So I think you could see this Thailand trip as a mini practice run. It was an 85-minute flight from Yangon to Bangkok, but what a world away to suddenly be sitting
Indeed.
In this extraordinary session.
I expect her roadshow will carry on without running out of steam for a good while yet. Gwen Robinson, the FT's Bangkok correspondent, who's attending the World Economic Forum, thank you very much for joining us.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture, from the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
During next week's Quality of Life Week, join me, Andrew Tuck, as I take over the second half of Midori House with a mayoral special, looking at the people running cities from Kabul to Geneva, Atlanta to Tel Aviv. Meet the people with City Hall challenges as diverse as luring in diplomats to getting water to come out of taps, wooing big business to tapping into people's downtime pleasures. So put on your finest chains and robes for a meeting with the mayor all next week on The Briefing here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. And this one, well, time for a song now, and it's about the subject of our previous item, Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi. This is U2 with the song they wrote for her, Walk On.
And love is not the easy thing, the only baggage that you can bring. Love.
U2 with Walk On. It's coming up for 23 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House. Welcome back to Midori House. Amid the man-made mountain range of Manhattan, a building has to stand exceptionally tall to be noticed. But it will be tough to overlook the development proposed for the long-vacant former site of the Drake Hotel in New York City. CIM Group, a Los Angeles company founded by two former Israeli paratroopers, plans to build New York's tallest residential building at the location, 432 Park. It will be called, and it will be a 425-metre tower designed by Uruguayan architect Rafael Vignoli. Joining me now is Kevin Brass, journal editor for the Council on Tall Buildings. Good evening, Kevin.
Good evening.
Do we have any ideas yet about what 432 Park might look like?
Not specifically, but it's certainly intriguing that such a well-known architect is involved, and it is part of a trend of these top architects designing residential towers. Right now, the tallest residential tower in New York is 8 Spruce Street, which was designed by Frank Gehry, which won our award last year for the top building in the Americas.
Okay, and what kind of, if we're not sure exactly what it looks like or what it will look like, what do we know about Rafael Vignoli's previous designs? What's his signature?
Well, in London, he's known for the walkie-talkie building, which is under construction. And literally looks like a walkie-talkie. In New York, he was known for jazz at Lincoln Center. What's interesting is these type of architects were traditionally known for museums and universities and those type of buildings. And it's a relatively recent phenomenon that they've started doing these types of residential towers.
I mean, when you sort of you say you know. You the building you get talking about the building you gave the award last year. What to your mind characterizes a good tall residential building? What makes a tower block a desirable place to live?
Well, there's two different elements there in terms of what makes it an interesting and award worthy building for us. It's the creativity. It's the use of space. It's the efficiency. It's a design that not only stands out but also creates an environment that people want to live in and serves that purpose in many ways. In terms of what makes a building desirable to buy in, well, that's a different factor. And believe me, the reason this building is going up is because of the outlandish amount of money that people are spending to buy these kinds of apartments.
Well, the quotes that are being bandied about for apartment space in 432 Park run to about $4,500 per square foot. Is that good value?
Well, I'll just, as a point of comparison, a penthouse in a building not far from this one just a few weeks ago reportedly sold for $90 million U.S. That's $90 million. Another building in this area in Manhattan recently sold an apartment to a Russian buyer for $88 million, reportedly in order so his daughter had a place to live while she went to school. So that type of money is driving this type of construction.
Well, yeah, I think that's when you know you've really made it, when you can afford to spend $88 million on somewhere for your daughter to crash while she's at college. Yeah.
Dorm rooms are so inconvenient.
But it does lead me to another thought I had about 432 Park, which will obviously, by dint of the size it is and where it is, it will become one of the most famous buildings in the world. And is that a selling point to people who are already wealthy and famous? I would have thought it would be a bit of a turnoff.
Well, that's a good point, and there's some debate about that. One of the things we do as the council is bestow titles of the world's tallest in different cities and in the country and in the world, and that can be seen as a positive or a negative. I think overall it's seen as a positive. People want to be in these iconic buildings. That's why you pay a top architect like Raphael Vanoli to design the building, is because it's distinctive, and it's because it has that extra allure because of the star power of the architect. And I think these iconic buildings, in fact, do have an edge in marketing, especially to the level of consumer they're shooting for, and that is an international consumer.
I mean, on the subject, though, of iconic addresses, when New York and New Yorkers, especially the New Yorkers who don't have $88 million to spend on an apartment, contemplate one of these proposals, is the sort of interminable process of the redevelopment of the World Trade Center site regarded as a bad omen? Do people still get excited about buildings like this?
Oh, I think on one level, people do get excited. They love the designs. They love the thrill of new skyscrapers. World Trade Center, of course, is set apart for many different reasons on a both sociological and cultural level, but also on such a symbolic level for New York. It's such an important building for the city. But I think if you expand out to social and cultural issues, yes, there are many other issues connected with these buildings. Is Manhattan, pricing itself out of a certain market where people can no longer afford to live in the city? It's a bigger issue sometimes in terms of how and why cities are developed. Are these buildings connected to the larger urban environment? Are they being built for just the wealthy, or are they being part of a growing, vital city?
I mean, when you're sort of considering what's obviously going to be a high-profile development like this, what would be one thing that you and your colleagues at the Council on Tall Buildings, what's one thing that you would like the developers to include or to think of in their design?
I would say, the name of our group is the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, and sometimes tall building developers forget the second part of that. If we look, and this might be a little more of my personal opinion, but I think in general it's true of our members and the group, is that we look at how the building integrates into the larger urban fabric. A lot of great buildings stand alone, they're isolated, they're not integrated into the transportation, into green spaces, and very often they're not very good places for people to live and work. We look at tall buildings as a chance to create a larger urban environment, and we think that's really important in terms of these designs, and far too often they're overlooked.
Kevin Brass from the Council on Tall Buildings, thank you very much for joining us this evening. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And in the next half hour on Midori House, the former mayor of Beijing appears to go as close as any Chinese official has to saying sorry for the Tiananmen Square massacre. We'll contemplate the tricky art of the public apology. But first, the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has criticized Russia's resistance to UN action on Syria, warning that its continued support for the Assad regime could contribute to a civil war. Mrs. Clinton told an audience of students in Copenhagen that unless unchecked, the deadly violence in Syria could lead to civil war or even develop into a proxy war because of Iran's support for the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Israel has handed over to the Palestinian government the remains of 91 militants, including suicide bombers, in a move it said was designed to induce Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to renew peace talks. However, Palestinian leaders signalled no shift in their refusal to negotiate as long as Israel continued building settlements on land where they hoped to establish a state. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Greece has given a warning over what it said was the rise of racist violence in the country, where large numbers of migrants arrive every year. The group says the financial crisis that has swept the country has weakened efforts to tackle the issue. The International Monetary Fund Deputy Managing Director Nemat Shafik has said that Eurozone countries could be given more time to cut their budget deficits below 3% of GDP. Eurozone countries signed a fiscal treaty by which they're obliged to cut budget deficits below 3%. Ms. Shafiq acknowledged that this goal may be hard to reach in times of economic crisis. The Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny was among the early voters today as Ireland went to the polls on the European Fiscal Treaty. About 3.1 million people have the right to vote in the only referendum being held across the EU on the controversial agreement to impose stricter budget controls. The mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, has called for a municipal ban on sales of supersized sugary drinks in an attempt to tackle obesity. He wants to stop the city's outlets from selling large sizes of sweetened soft drinks. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
Thanks, James. Since 1989, the Chinese government's official line on Tiananmen Square has essentially amounted to nothing of interest has ever happened at this address at all, ever. Look, there's a puppy over there. This obduracy makes it all the more remarkable that the mayor of Beijing at the time of the massacre, Chen Jitong, has said in a book published this week that he is sorry about the deaths of, at the very least, hundreds of pro-democracy campaigners at the hands of the People's Liberation Army. Now, granted, Jitong may think he has nothing to lose, though the 81-year-old at one point rose to the height of a seat on the Politburo, he has long since been consigned to the outer darkness by the Communist Party, and since leaving office has served a 16-year prison sentence on corruption charges. Will his apology mean anything? How much do apologies ever mean? Well, we'll ask someone who should know shortly, but first, a couple of famous apologies. First up, Tiger Woods enters the record books as the world's first interesting golfer.
Many of you in this room are my friends. Many in this room know me. Many of you have cheered for me, or you worked with me, or you supported me. Now, every one of you has good reason to be critical of me. I want to say to each of you, simply and directly, I am deeply sorry.
And Bill Clinton attempts to negotiate his way back to the White House from the doghouse.
Still, I must take complete responsibility for all my actions, both public and private. And that is why I am speaking to you tonight. As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Ms. Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
Well, joining me now to discuss whether either of these men did right about what they did wrong is Susan Wise Bauer, author of The Art of the Public Grovel. Good evening, Susan.
Good evening.
How are public apologies different from the ones that we might make in our personal lives?
Unfortunately, there's often a startling resemblance between them in that we don't really apologize. To apologize is to admit wrong. To take responsibility, something that so far as I can see, the mayor certainly did not, that Clinton only gradually got around to. So an apology can express a sense of contrition, a sense of I did something wrong, I need to be forgiven, but a lot of times it's simply an expression of impersonal regret.
Well, what makes for a successful public apology, and can you think of a particular example of one that's actually worked for the apologizer?
Yeah. Well, a successful apology doesn't skirt around the issue. It doesn't express regret without taking responsibility. It says, this is what I did. I am sorry for it. I am personally responsible for it. No one else is personally responsible for it. I hope that one day those of you who are listening can forgive me and readmit me to your good graces. That's what an effective public apology does. Clinton actually did finally make one. It just took him quite a while to get around to it.
It was sort of an apology in several installments over quite a long period of time.
Exactly. He started off by not apologizing at all, and then he sort of worked his way into it backwards until finally he was doing, at a national prayer breakfast, he did a full-on grovel on the floor, complete with quoting from the Psalms. Just took him a while to get there.
And what makes, I guess, you know, that fleshes out a bit of an answer to my next question, but can you think of any particular examples of a calamitously unsuccessful public apology?
On the American scene, we've had quite a few. We've had quite a few erring televangelists, for example, who managed to not apologize at all, who were caught with their hand in someone else's pocketbook or their entire body in someone else's bed, and the best they could come up with was, well, I'm sorry, but, and then following the but was an excuse explaining why it wasn't really their fault. Jimmy Swaggart did this. Jim Baker did this. So our televangelists have been particularly bad at saying that they're sorry.
I mean, the political apology in particular now does have this almost ritualistic confessional quality to it. Do you think voters actually take it seriously, or do they just tend to tune it out?
It depends. And it also depends on the part of the country. I mean, here in the U.S., especially in the South and in the Southeast, there are sort of these evangelical terms that you can use that do actually seem to strike a real chord with a majority of voters. You get up into New England or somewhere out in the West, and they're a lot less likely to listen to you. But partly, I think the religious language is a stand-in for an assurance to us that the politician is trustworthy. When the politician is using this religious language, he's using a language of accountability that is millennia old. It's a language that says, I understand that I have to answer to someone larger than myself for what I did. And it's a very powerful language. And because of that, I think that voters do tend to pay attention, even if they're not particularly religiously inclined.
I mean, is there ever, it's hard to know whether this is a cynical approach to take or not, but is there ever a time when an apology represents an opportunity, that if a successful apology can actually elevate your standing beyond what it was before you did whatever it was that you're apologizing for?
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, that absolutely is a cynical point of view to take, and it's also completely true. I think that Clinton came out of his whole mess much better respected than he had been before. He managed, through the apology, and this is what a really well-done apology can do, he managed to convince all of these voters that he was just like them, that he was just a poor schmuck who made a mistake and, you know, needed to be forgiven for it and needed to be helped and supported. He asked people to pray for him. He asked people to hold him accountable. He asked people to forgive him. He very successfully turned himself into an everyman. I mean, here is this Ivy League-educated lawyer, white lawyer, holding the highest position of power in the United States, who managed to convince people that he was just Joe on the street. And because of that, he came out on the other side much more popular.
I mean, it's always hard to know in a situation like that is whether the sincerity is important or not. I mean, or are we now in the realm of that old joke is that, you know, the sincerity is the key, and once you can fake that, you're laughing?
I think that's absolutely where we are. The sincerity, it's hard even to know what sincerity means in a context like a public apology from a politician. But sincerity to us means he doesn't immediately go out and do the same thing again.
Just finally, Susan, as the author of a book about public apologies, which is a riotously entertaining read, I have to say, The Art of the Public Grovel, do you have a particular favorite public apology?
I have to say, I have never been a Clinton fan, but I really have a sneaking admiration for the way in which he managed to hit every single high note. I sat there and listened to that apology again and again, the final one at the prayer breakfast, and I thought, now what I really want to know is he working off political instinct, which he may be, or does he have a team of people who have selected every single word for maximum effect, because, man, that was a virtuoso performance.
I think Bill Clinton was just one of those people who would follow you into a revolving door and come out in front. Susan Weisbauer, author of The Art of the Public Grovel, which is an absolutely fantastic read. Thank you very much for joining us. And here is an appropriate song from their 1986 album, Liberty Bell and the Black Diamond Express. It's The Go-Betweens, with Apology Accepted. Go-Betweens, Apology Accepted, concluding track of my particular favourite album of all time ever, for what that's worth. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be right back after this.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition, complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair. And that's fair with a Y, of course.
Of course, it's fair with a Y. It's quarter to 1900 hours here on Monocle 24. Normally, champagne wouldn't last 200 years. Even if someone didn't drink it in that interval, sun and oxidisation would turn it bad. That is, if the bubbly in question is not protected from the elements and the thirsty by a few hundred metres of Baltic Sea. In 2010, Swedish divers discovered 168 bottles of French champagne on a shipwreck near the Finnish archipelago of Åland. Thought to be the world's oldest theoretically drinkable champagne, the first bottles to be auctioned reached €30,000. Now 16 more are going under the hammer, not literally, one hopes, and unnecessarily wealthy wine lovers around the world are watching the lot closely. Earlier, Monocle's Sophie Grove and Louise Beale talked to Bjorn Hegblom, head of communications of the government of Åland, about the significance of this.
First of all, tell us a little bit about this vintage. It sounds fascinating. Do we know what brand of champagne this is?
Yes, we do. As you said, they were found in a shipwreck in 2010, but the bottles are from the 1800s, from the first half of the 1800s. We don't have the exact date of all the bottles, but they are from three famous champagne houses. One house is Veuve Clicquot, and another is Heidsieck, and the third is Juglar, which ceased to exist in 1829, but today goes under the name of Jackson.
I mean, it's an incredible story. It's fascinating. And as a champagne lover myself, do we know what this tastes like? Is it drinkable? And does it taste sort of different or remarkably different from champagne that you might drink now?
Oh, it's absolutely drinkable. I can say because I have had the opportunity to taste it myself.
Wow.
And, you know, it's a bit different, though, from modern champagne, which is much drier and, of course, a bit more fizzy. They added lots of more sugar in the 1800s in the champagne. So it's much sweeter, more towards a dessert wine. But I have never, ever in my life tasted something with, you know, such, you know, incredible taste and long aftertaste, just an experience that I will, you know, live with me forever.
I'm glad the government of Åland splashed out or kept a bottle for themselves, Björn. But I would like to, I mean, do you know anything about how this vintage got to the bottom of the Baltic Sea?
Well, we don't know the name of the vessel that sank, but we do know some bits of information that it most likely was a boat traveling from the northern parts of Germany towards Finland, and that it sank sometime during the first half of the 1800s in the fall, because they also found grapes, so it must have been on the fall after the harvest of the grapes. And we also found bottles of beer that are also have been very interesting for us. You know, recently we had a press conference where we could tell that there were still living live bacteria in this beer, and the kind of good bacteria that can be used for food and health applications in modern research.
Now, 16 bottles of this champagne are going under the hammer, as we mentioned. Do we know who might be interested in buying it, what kind of price it's going to go for, how much do we know about the actual auction?
Well, there's actually 11 old bottles that will go for sale, and in addition to that, also other lots of champagne that will be sold. But of the old shipwreck champagne bottles, there are 11 bottles up for sale. And we did hit the world record last time around when we sold only 2 bottles. And the most expensive one then sold for 30,000 euros. This time, I believe that we will hit the world record again, because we have been hearing that some of the, you know, collectors of champagne globally have been talking about having a big interest in buying these unique bottles. And one of the bottles that goes for sale is the Heidsieck bottle, which was not up for sale the last time. And there are only a few of them, so I think a lot of people are expecting that the Heidsieck bottle might go for a new record. And somewhere that would mean more than 30,000 euros for one single bottle.
And Björn, where does the lure of the sea stand on who reaps the financial benefits of this auction, which could be considerable, it sounds?
Yes, it all goes to a good cause, towards the maritime environment in the Baltic Sea. So that is another good thing, I think, too. Because, you know, logically, these bottles were brought up from the sea, and now we are putting something back, you know, for the environment in the waters.
And what's been the reaction to well, A, these bottles being found, but B, the auction? Is there a lot of excitement around it?
Definitely. And as I think we will see that this auction is growing by each year. Last year was the first time, and now it will be even more bottles up for sale. And so the collectors and others who have a genuine interest in old wines are sure to be bidding. That we are certain. And we will also have some people flying in from the United States and other places to be here live at the auction. But of course, it's possible to bid over the internet or over the phone as well.
And that was Björn Hägglum, Head of Communications of the Government of Åland, talking to Monocle's Sophie Grove and Louise Beal. You're listening to Midori House. Welcome back. There's nothing quite like checking in with a correspondent slaving away on a tough story in an unforgiving foreign location. And this next item is nothing like checking in with a correspondent slaving away on a tough story in an unforgiving foreign location. Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw, is in Marrakesh attending the Financial Times Business of Luxury Conference. Good evening, Jonathan.
Good evening, Andrew. It is a tough assignment.
It is a tough life, and we've been very grateful back here in the office that you agreed to take this one on and spare the rest of us from having to put ourselves through this this arduous few days. How are you holding up?
I'm dealing okay. I've got the Riyadh that we're staying in to console me, so it's fine. Kate and I are staying in the Riyadh El Fen, which is one of these converted merchant houses owned by the sister of Richard Branson. So, yeah, it's nice.
It sounds awful. The theme of this year's Business of Luxury conference is luxury and lifestyle, which seems a fairly open-ended description. What exactly are people discussing?
Yeah, well, so the theme that the FT set is the lifestyle revolution, which is essentially they've been tracking this trend over the last year for luxury brands to be diversifying into kind of areas that would normally be seen as the realms of lifestyle. So we're talking about food, we're talking hospitality, we're even talking cars and things. So it's luxury brands moving from their core competencies and expanding out. But, I mean, people have struggled a bit because when you're dealing with terms such as luxury and lifestyle, which are banded around so much and really kind of have no analytic value. I mean, certainly with luxury now, you can have a luxury coffee, you can have a luxurious chocolate bar, which is kind of a world away from what it was originally kind of meant to intend, kind of mean. So, yeah, it's a challenging topic, and I think lots of the delegates have had a lot to say about it.
I mean, are the brands still, the brands that have always characterized themselves as luxury brands, still happy to be characterized as such? Or is it a label that in a time of austerity, or at least theoretical austerity, people are retreating from slightly or trying to retreat from?
Well, I think this is the thing, is that luxury has so many different entry points. And I think over the last few years, certainly it's become a bit of a dirty word, and certainly looking at the kind of growth rates that you've seen for groups like Richemont or PPR in China, when they're kind of doing 40% growth a year, when a lot of people are in pretty straitened economic conditions. So, yeah, I mean, it has become a dirty word in that sense, but also there's a move to kind of reclaim luxury to what it originally meant, which is, you know, standing for a brand that has real craftsmanship, a real sense of focus, sense of history, rarity, and which is just extremely good at what it does. So I think it's more that the semantics are complicated, but luxury itself is not. That's not really as much up to today.
I mean, is a conference of this sort in a location of this sort? Does it feel like it's in a little bubble untouched by the economic crisis in Europe, or is it being discussed a lot?
Well, I was expecting the Eurozone crisis to be the big topic this year because it was very underplayed last year. But again, it isn't centre stage. We actually had the chief economist from Berenberg Bank this morning arguing that Europe is going to become the most dynamic and interesting area in the Western world over the next 2 years because of all the financial reforms that are happening. So it is a bubble. I mean, again, you're dealing with brands which are experiencing huge, huge growth. And even in Europe, the investment in things like watches and fine jewellery has never been better because, you know, in times of crisis, people like luxury. So there is a sense, you know, sitting in the Four Seasons in Marrakesh in these quite peaceful, opulent conditions, that a lot of the kind of key players in international luxury are living a different life to you and me.
To say the very least, and you're living a different life to me just by being there, he said resentfully. But is there anything in particular you've seen or heard which has struck you as surprising, I guess, something you weren't expecting from this summit so far?
Well, one thing that's really stuck with me, I don't think it's necessarily surprising, but it kind of gave some figures to something which I've been looking at and expecting for a while, which is the luxury market in Brazil. So I was out in Brazil, about 6 weeks ago now, doing a piece for Monocle on the luxury market there and seeing the kind of most extraordinarily hungry market for luxury in a different way to China, which is just a very kind of trend-driven consumption. But this was a full 3D economy where they live and breathe luxury at hugely inflated prices because of the taxes in Brazil and the rest of it. But there was an interesting speech from the head of statistics at American Express, and he basically says that for Brazilian Amex customers, 78% of spending on their cards was overseas. And he said that there's anecdotal evidence that TAM, the Brazilian airline, had to load up on more fuel on return trips from New York than outward trips just because of the sheer weight of luxury goods that were being carted back by these Brazilian luxury tourists. So it's this story which we've been following for a while but haven't had hard stats for, which is that the kind of the luxury tourist from Brazil or China is just a huge, huge opportunity for the old traditional European shopping centres. And again, he pointed to statistics from the main shopping streets in these cities. So on the Champs-Élysées in Paris, for example, 71% of purchases are from foreign buyers. On the Via Monte Napoleone in Milan, it's 62%. And in Bond Street in London, it's 45%. So, yeah, those are quite extraordinary, and it's kind of given statistics to a hunch that we've had for a while.
Jonathan, with that, we shall let you get back to it. A tough job, but somebody has to do it. Jonathan Openshaw, Monocle's business editor at the Business of Luxury Conference in Marrakesh. And that's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. Thanks very much to our producer, Hannah Jenkins, researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and studio manager Toby Hammond. In 3 hours' time, 2200, I'll be back for The Daily with Emma Nelson. But up next is the news, followed by this week's edition of The Urbanist.